Hello, I'm Suzanne Paris. This is number 0283, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0283. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, you'll meet Pat Pattison, who is the host of Remade in America. He talks about a midlife reinvention and why he believes it's never too late to reinvent yourself.
The whole theme of my show and book and coaching practice is it's never too late. I have a great story of Martin Sheen being on Garrison Keillor's show, Prairie Home Companion, and said he was going back to college. And Garrison Keillor said, gee, you're 66. By the time you get out of college, you're going to be 70. And Martin Sheen said, I'm going to be 70 anyway.
Patrick Lee, author of Kickers, a novel of the secret war. It tells the story of the smoke jumpers who fought a secret war for the CIA in Laos.
When I started hearing about the death of my smoke jumper buddy, I tried to research it and find out through them what was going on. Why had this happened? Nobody was talking. And in my research, I discovered that the smoke jumpers hadn't gotten recognition in a secret war into which they were recruited by the CIA and at the direction of three different U.S. presidents who denied the war ever happened.
Stuart Nullman is back with another edition of Book Banter.
Hi, I'm Stuart Nullman. On this week's Book Banter, Hunter Davies looks at the story behind all of the Beatles' lyrics. It's going to be a hard day's night later on the Stuff File program.
And of course, there's lots and lots of Stuff File news, and of course, an idiot of the day. The guest later, the person who told you this was show number 0283, was Suzanne Paris, a writer and graphic artist here in Montreal. She has a little bronchitis, but that just makes her voice all that much more sexier. Not that it doesn't need the help, generally speaking. Thank you very much, Suzanne, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program, a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? And we start off with the Darwin file. A Florida man is dead after accidentally shooting himself in the face while allegedly threatening to shoot a dog. Police say 57-year-old Dennis Eugene Emery was declared dead at the scene after the incident in Pinellas Park near St. Petersburg. Because, as you know, everything happens at Walmart or Florida or both. Yes. He was involved in a domestic disturbance with his wife, said Sergeant Adam Geisenberger of the Pinellas Park Police Department. He said, during that disturbance, he retrieves a firearm, he produces the firearm, and he threatens to shoot one of the family's animals. Neighbors say Emery's wife had 13 dogs, and the barking was a source of tension between the two of them. While allegedly threatening to shoot the dog, Emery pulled the hammer back on his revolver. When trying to release the hammer, however, the gun went off. Well, I guess she gets to keep all the dogs. Because as you know, when we talk about the Darwin file, the tree of life is often self-pruning. Okay, Dakota Navzinger of Kansas City, Missouri, was born without eyes. Now, while the 8-year-old was on the school bus heading to school, the bus driver says Dakota hit another student with his white cane. Dakota's father said his son lifts his cane sometimes, and apparently the bus driver thought he was purposefully trying to hurt someone else. Accidental or not, Grace Moore Elementary School officials punished him by taking away his cane for 2 weeks and replacing it with a foam swimming pool noodle. Okay, this is an 8-year-old blind kid, may I remind you. Just want to state that again, because some people might not be clear on that. Certainly, the school isn't. Anyway, school officials didn't want to talk to the media, but district spokeswoman Michelle Kronk did, saying they justified the action because the cane was school property provided to Dakota at enrollment. Why a pool noodle? Well, Dakota fidgets and needs something to hold, Kronk said. It's a lot harder with this, Dakota said, indicating the swimming pool flotation device can't feel things. Well, you know why, Dakota? I mean, you're 8 years old, but you already know why. Because this isn't designed for someone who is blind. Apparently, the school doesn't understand this. Anyway, after the story hit the news and caused widespread outrage, the school district backed down, saying it is reviewing the situation, and decided a mistake was made. They drove to the boy's house to return the cane, apologized, and announced they are working to rectify the situation. Yes, well, Dakota may be blind, but I'm sure he's not blind to the stupidity of the school officials at the school he goes to. Meanwhile, moving right along, when Jack and Lydia Leather's son was born, they kept alive the tradition started by Jack's parents. My parents decided they wanted to name their son something to make their parents mad, said Jack, who is now 31. And at the time, my dad was drinking Jack, which he enjoyed. My mom said, why not? Thus, Jack's middle name is Daniels. And throughout his life, he has been called Jack Daniels after the liquor brand. Nobody believed my name until I showed them my ID, he said. When I went into the army, sergeants would yell, how much more American can you get than Jack Daniels? So the couple named their son Jim Beam to continue the tradition. If we have another child, our second born will be Evan Williams after the bourbon. If it's a girl, she will be Sherry, like the cooking Sherry, says Lydia, who is 23. That's the mom. We get a lot of flack from other people about it, she added. At the end of the day, it's our son, and it's what we wanted to do. Well, when you think about it, they are appropriate names, given those products are often the cause of many children actually being here. Think about that. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, who shot her? The 911 dispatcher asked the 4 a.m. caller from Peachtree City, Georgia. Me, the caller answered. The gun was in the bed. I went to move it, put it aside, and it went off. And then it gets weird, by the way, this story does. You're the chief of police in Peachtree City? The dispatcher asked. Yeah, unfortunately, replied William McCollum, since July. He had said he accidentally shot his wife, Margaret McCollum, who was 58, in the back while both were home in bed, sleeping early New Year's morning. His wife was hospitalized in critical condition. The weapon was his service pistol, a Glock 9mm. McCollum, who was also 58, has been placed on administrative leave, and the Georgia Bureau of Investigation has stepped in to investigate the shooting. Mrs. McCollum is expected to survive. The survival of Mr. McCollum's career is much more in doubt, however. And at press time, I also don't know exactly how charitable the wife is feeling towards her hubby. He may have to sleep with one eye open from now on in the future. Anyway, let's get to our first guest, shall we? Here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Are you someone who has the feeling in midlife that you have missed your calling? Is it too late to do something about it? That's a question we put to Pat Pattison. He's a life coach and teacher and the founding partner of the Incentive Plus Network, which is an agency specializing in marketing for the TV industry. He's also the host of Remade in America. And Pat joins us on the line right now from California. Hi, Pat.
Hi, Peter. How are you?
Just tickety-boo. Thanks for being on the program with us. So
appreciate it.
Right off the bat, I'll ask the question, is it too late to do something about it if you feel you've missed your calling?
No, the whole theme of my show and book and coaching practice is it's never too late. You know, I have a great story of Martin Sheen being on Garrison Keillor's show, Prairie Home Companion, and said he was going back to college. And Garrison Keillor said, gee, you're 66. By the time you get out of college, you're going to be 70. And Martin Sheen said, I'm going to be 70 anyway.
Good point.
So I think the thing that's happening to a vast number of the population is just that we're living longer. Because of the economic downturn, there may be not as much financial stability. So people are reinventing themselves out of necessity, but also realizing that this might be a good way to design the second half, third act, anything you want to call it.
Okay, now, when we talk about people who reinvent themselves, we usually talk about a particular type of individual, and I'm sure you can list a host of people who have turned their lives around and done different things after a certain particular age. But is part of that having to do with that type of personality to begin with? In other words, can everybody really do this, or does it take a certain type of person?
I think anybody can do it. I think it takes a certain program that you have to implement for yourself. As I mentioned, I have a website, patpattison.net, and I have a Facebook page that's Pat Pattison's Remade in America. And part of what I do as a coach is to determine first what is the yearning, you know, what is the thing that you want to remake. There's no point in going through this process unless you're doing something really bitching, right? Something that you really want to do and that you get excited about getting out of bed in the morning. So once we have that, probably the most common denominator I've seen for people that have successfully remade themselves is they set up little experiments. They come up with what we call other possible selves. So let's say you're a radio host, and the other possible self you might want to look at is that you want to take up an instrument that you played when you were young, but now you want to do it more often, or you want to, you know, be in a jazz trio. And so you come up with little ways to try that out, see if it's still a passion, see if it's still something that is worth integrating into your life, and you do it. I think the mistake that a lot of people make is they start doing charts and graphs and plus columns and minus columns, and they think they're going to think their way into a remade life. And it's my experience, because I've done this myself, is that you have to act your way into a remade life.
One of the problems, though, some people might have with talking about something like this is the fact that life gets in the way of whatever plans you might want to make. I, as someone who is single, can decide to reinvent myself as many times as I want to because I'm only dealing with me. But what if you have obligations, children, family that you have to deal with? Those kind of things that can, I guess, plug you deeply more into reality.
Yeah. Well, there's something that's called a montage career, and it's the idea that you can create multiple revenue streams for yourself. So let's say that you are in a position where you can do what you normally do on a part-time basis, okay, and then you can expand and do your new passion on a part-time basis as well. A lot of people are doing this after the kids, you know, leave for college, or, you know, they might have a small pension, or they might have a small retirement fund. So there's, you know, the thing that I think people have to get in touch with is how important is it? Can they prioritize it in their life? A lot of people can't. You know, a lot of people, end up in a place where it may be a five-year plan as opposed to something I'm going to do in the next 60 days. So part of my approach in my coaching and in my book is that you really have to think long-term about this. It can't be kind of an impulsive, situation.
Obviously, when we're talking about somebody remaking their lives, we're talking about just based on the ages of someone having a midlife change is probably someone who is, shall we say, a young baby boomer. Now, there's a certain personality trait of those who are baby boomers in general. And that brings me back to my question earlier about, does it take a certain type of personality? And do you find that all generations possess that type of personality?
I think they do. I mean, you're right. It's probably normally, you know, if I was going to say in terms of my own clients, you know, I would say 80% of them are 45 plus, you know. But I think this idea of reinventing yourself can also happen in place. I think there are people that have certain jobs that maybe they're, you know, tired of, or they have, you know, or they're worried about getting fired. I interviewed on my show Stan Freese, who has been the talent booking director for the Disney parks for 42 years. So the reason I had him on my show is he's reinvented himself in the music industry numerous times to stay in that job. So the application of these ideas of being teachable, you know, being passionate, learning to focus, all of these apply, whether it's to completely change careers or simply stay relevant in your existing career.
The reason why I brought up that question, the flip side of that last question I just asked, is the baby boomer is probably the last generation that will have the opportunity or had the opportunity to get into a job, stick with it, and retire from it. The younger generations, by necessity, don't necessarily have that option available to them.
It's tough. It's a tough time, and I think that's why this is even more relevant than ever. I think that what we're talking about, you know, in terms of a certain demo, 45 plus as an option or a luxury, will be a necessity for the younger people. They will have multiple jobs. I don't remember the statistics, but you know, I think the average stay at a job is 2 years now, you know, and they'll probably have somewhere in the neighborhood of 8 or 9 separate, you know, almost careers in terms of their work cycle. So they might as well plan that as opposed to be reactive to it, you know, and that's what my whole program of these montage careers is about. It's planning, it's taking, you know, what I want to do over the next 2, 3, 4 years and really make it a priority so that it can be a design that I can implement and carry out.
We've divided it amongst the generational divide, but what about gender? Is what you're saying, is what you're suggesting easier to convince or teach men or women, or does it make no difference at all?
You know, it's a funny thing. I don't want to generalize, but just in terms of my transition coaching clients, there's two challenges. One is with the men that maybe have had high-powered jobs, they've been executives, maybe they've gotten laid off, maybe they, you know, their jobs become obsolete, their trade has become obsolete. For them, I would say in general, they have to be, their ego and their identity of being the VP or the senior VP has to be minimized for them to succeed. In other words, their ego has to be taken down a notch, and they have to start going, well, maybe I can start over in this career, and maybe, you know, maybe everybody's not going to jump when I ask them to snap to attention because I'm not in this powerful job. Maybe people aren't going to return my calls like they used to because I'm not vice president of whatever. The flip side of that is many women maybe have raised their children. Maybe they had a high-powered job or a successful career. Maybe that's been put on hold 5, 10, 15 years. They have the reverse problem where they need to build their confidence back up. So it is a very different process. And here again, I'm not to generalize, but that tends to be what I notice in my own clients.
Very interesting topic indeed. People can find more information by going to your website, which is patpattison.net. We just have just under a minute. Very quickly, can you tell us what we'll find when we go to the website?
Yeah, what you'll find on the website is a way to sign up for my newsletter, some information, and a bunch of episodes of my show, Pat Pattison's Remade in America. Love everybody to take a look at it.
Excellent. Pat, thank you very much for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Oh, Okay, you bet, Peter. I appreciate your interest.
Pat Pattison, host of Remade in America. You can check out his website at patpattison.net. You can also go to my website at thestufffile.com. Go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0283, and you'll find the link.
You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Kelly Alexander's show is your place to be for everything to do with health, lifestyle, and entertainment. Join us as we chat with celebrities like Emmy winner Mia Michaels from So You Think You Can Dance, best-selling recording artist Taylor Dane, and world-renowned astronaut Julie Payette. We also cover important topics like breast cancer awareness and how to help your child through bullying. All this and more, please join us, www.kellyalexandershow.com.
It's The Kelly Alexander Show.
Capture your need for sound.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey, your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of The Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick, if you know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands. Just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
If you're listening to this while walking with your iPod, make sure you look both ways before you cross the street. It's safety first on The Stuff File with Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk to the author of Kickers, a novel of the secret war. Plus, Stuart Nullman will be along with another edition of Book Banter. There's, of course, lots more Stuff File news and an idiot of the day coming your way a little later on. Here on a program also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. And, I really can't talk about Stitcher enough. I mean, if you want to hear this show or a myriad of other shows, such as maybe 20,000 different shows, actually more than 20,000 different shows now, then you really need to download the free app, and that way you could listen anytime, anywhere. Stitcher is an award-winning free app that lets you listen to all of your favorite shows, plus discover new favorites, like I said, well over 20,000 shows, news, entertainment, and sports shows. You can create custom playlists, and you can rate and review the shows that you hear on Stitcher. So, by the way, if you like the Stuff File program and you happen to be on Stitcher, give me a rate or two, okay? Thank you very much. It's available for the iOS, Android, Nook, iPad, just basically every mobile device that's out there. And it's in over 4 million car dashboards. It's radio on demand. We're talking about Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. That's how a lot of you are listening to this show right now. But there's a lot more of you out there that could be. So what are you waiting for? Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Let's get right back to the stuff, shall we? Well, we have a couple of stories that illustrate the exciting things that researchers do. Number one, the natural enemy of the Hawkmoth, or hawk, is it hawk moth? Hawk moth. That's what I'm trying to say. The natural enemy of the hawk moth, which has been the natural enemy of the hawk moth for about 65 million years, is the bat. But thanks to a recent study by biologists at Boise State University and the University of Florida, we know the reason why so many hawk moths are able to avoid their predator. They signal each other by rubbing their genitals on their abdomens, which somehow mimics bats' own high-frequency sounds. Gosh, who knew? Don't try that at home, by the way. I'm just telling you that right now. And when they mimic those high-frequency sounds, this works kind of like a jamming device for the bats' oral ability to detect the hawk moth's locations. Now, professors Jesse Barber and Akito Karahawa, working in Malaysia, tethered a hawk moth to a wire and then tracked a bat using slow motion cameras and high definition microphones, painstakingly examining the results for a 2014 journal article. And story number two, under the headline of What Researchers Do, bringing the total number of cow sounds to three is basically what you could call this one. A team from Britain's University of Nottingham and Queen Mary University of London found, according to a December BBC News report, that cows make two distinctly different call sounds to their calves depending on whether the calves are nearby. A low-frequency mooing with their mouth closed, or whether the calves are further away or separated from the mother cow. In this case, a higher-frequency sound. The team said it spent 10 months digitally recording cow noises, then a year, an entire year, analyzing them by computer. What would be more exciting is what I want to know. Listening to these researchers gush about their findings while sitting in on a seminar that they're giving, or sitting next to one of these guys and hearing their story while on a transatlantic flight. You decide, and get back to me on that later, okay? Meanwhile, we have a couple of stories here proving once again that some folks just aren't ready for a life of crime. We call them the not nearly ready for prime time. Number one, a potential robber was turned away from a store on East Harry Street in Wichita, Kansas, back on December 11th, after he demanded cash, explaining to the clerk that he had six children and needed the money. The clerk told the man, "Well, you have too many kids." The man fled the store empty-handed. Well, not really subtle, but there you go. And story number two, a masked man approached a clerk at a Sam's Mart in New Haven, Connecticut on November 29th and passed a note demanding money while pointing his finger at the clerk, perhaps an inept attempt to feign having a gun in his pocket, you see. Usually when you use your finger, you keep it in your pocket, but anyway, I digress. According to police, the clerk grabbed the finger and threatened to break it, sending the man fleeing into the night, I'm assuming still with finger attached. What rookies. What rookies. Moving right along, in a joint operation in December, police in Beijing and three provinces broke up two prostitution rings that specialized in supplying young lactating mothers to Chinese men who pay to be breastfed. I think that bears repeating. In a joint operation in December, police in Beijing and three provinces broke up two prostitution rings that specialized in supplying young lactating mothers to Chinese men who pay to be breastfed. Yikes. Police said the women who provide sex with the meal, and I'm doing air quotes, earn even higher fees. The women had either stopped breastfeeding their babies or cut back in favor of their clients. Critics, according to the South China Morning Post, say this lactophilia, yes, apparently this is a term for it now, this lactophilia showed the moral degradation of China's rich. Now, what I want to know is how do things like this ever even get started? I mean, was it some rich guy pleading with people to be breastfed or some business person out there who felt there was a niche not being served? Either way, this just makes my head spin. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Okay, guys, you'll want to cross your legs because you're not going to enjoy this next story. A woman in China took revenge into her own hands, literally, when she discovered that her husband was unfaithful. Chinese officials have arrested a married woman who allegedly chopped off her husband's penis after she found his messages to a 21-year-old mistress. Fan Lung, a 32-year-old father of five, was sleeping when his wife, Feng, cut off his penis with a scissors. Oh, man. Ow. Yikes. She reportedly saw emails he wrote to his lover using her cell phone. Fan had his penis reattached, but was still in the hospital when Feng returned to cut off his penis once again. Staff rushed out to see what was happening and found the patient was covered in blood. It was streaming down his legs, and he was also hitting the woman, a hospital rep said in a statement. He was stopped, and the woman was taken in for treatment, and then we discovered she had chopped off his penis again. Unfortunately for Fan, authorities were unable to find his severed member, which is thought to have been eaten by a stray dog or cat. Okay, yikes. Wow, where do I begin? A few things jump out to me here. One, how does she even get a chance to visit her husband in hospital after what she did to him the first time? And, I mean, if you were her husband, wouldn't you be ringing for the night nurse and security the second you saw her face show up at your door in the hospital room? And two, they couldn't reattach the removed member because it had been eaten by a stray dog or a cat. Now, admittedly, I haven't been to a hospital in China recently, but what's the deal with these stray dogs and cats at a medical facility? That doesn't scream to me as being the height of sanitary conditions. Yeah. Anyway, let's move on, shall we? On to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Patrick Lee is a former smoke jumper who made 25 parachute jumps into the Idaho primitive area fighting forest fires. Later, he began to hear of smoke jumper deaths in Laos, including those of men who had been his jump partners. Interviews of surviving smoke jumpers about their CIA experiences in Laos convinced Lee their stories needed to be told. He incorporated core elements of their recollections into a book called Kickers, a novel of the secret war. Patrick joins us on the line right now from Idaho. Hi, Patrick.
Good evening, Peter.
Thanks for being on the program with us. Right off the bat, you've decided to put this story into a novel form. Why choose the novel route?
When I started hearing, as I was practicing law 100 years ago, about the deaths of my smoke jumper buddies, I tried to research it and find out through them what was going on. Why had this happened? Nobody was talking. And in my research, I discovered that the smoke jumpers hadn't gotten recognition in a secret war conducted by the, into which they were recruited by the CIA and at the direction of three different U.S. presidents who denied the war ever happened. They considered themselves patriots. They were fighting communism in the Cold War, but there was zero recognition from the government or in anything written about it. So I wanted immediately to tell the truth about the war and the smoke jumper role in it. And the fact is, very few Americans know anything about the war in Laos. Even well-read, informed people. I'm talking about lawyers. I'm making a lawyer joke. but I can do that. I'm a lawyer. I wanted to tell the truth about the war and the smoke jumpers and the CIA. Truth, in my view, is not the same as fact. Truth is what we feel about what happened. And that feeling can only be created through story. Truth about life has always been taught, conveyed by story, ever since we lived in caves. Nonfiction is great. I read more nonfiction than I do novels, but it does not lend itself, with some exceptions, to storytelling. Story is not an accumulation of information strung into a narrative. It's a design of events progressing to a meaningful climax. It's got progression and causality, and that's what I was seeking. War reported as fact simply doesn't have design, progression, and causation.
Okay, so as you say...
I've gone on a little long about why I wrote a novel.
As you say, this is a situation that a lot of the population, the general population, doesn't know anything about. You yourself were a smoke jumper, but not obviously in Laos. But how did you first get wind of this story?
It was rumor. A family relative who had been in the smoke jumpers with me called me and said, have you heard about Tex and Yogi? I said, no. What are you talking about? These are two smoke jumper buddies. And this was maybe 7 or 8 years after I had left smoke jumping. He said they were killed in an air crash in Laos. I didn't even know where Laos was, literally. I had to find it, and then I spent many, many years trying to find someone within the smoke jumper community that would talk to me about it. They had been told by the CIA not to tell anybody, family, girlfriend, anybody, about what they were doing. And they didn't do that. They didn't seek attention for themselves. They just shut up. And the CIA continued to employ them in various deniable, covert activities over the years. The smoke jumpers were involved, for example, in the training and supply operations that went into the Cuban invasion. No one's ever heard about the smoke jumpers being involved in that, but they were very much involved. So they continued to work for the CIA. Let me tell you, your listeners, a quick story.
Well, let me ask you a question first. Let's back up a little bit, because we keep mentioning smoke jumpers, which is something that you did in a forest fire capacity. First, very briefly, tell us what a smoke jumper is and how different from what you were doing in fighting fires is it to what was being done in these covert operations.
All right. Back in the 50s, smoke jumpers were used by the United States Forest Service. They were the only people that were involved with smoke jumpers to fight wilderness fires in roadless areas in the United States, and that means basically the Intermountain West, from New Mexico and Arizona on up to Montana and Idaho, and this sounds naive, particularly in light of how forest fires are fought today. But the rubric was every fire is out by 10 a.m. The following day of its report. And the only way you could do that is jump out of an airplane into the wilderness area. And the smoke jumpers were very successful at doing that. At that time, in the 50s and 60s, in their own histories, the U.S. Forest Service refers to those smoke jumper days as the college years, because they weren't recruiting trained, dedicated firefighters. They were recruiting college kids, and they were recruiting them because they thought they could quickly train them to jump out of an airplane and fight a fire. And we were available, and we were cheap.
Okay, so what was being done differently in covert operations because you weren't fighting fires, or the smoke jumpers weren't fighting fires there? What exactly were they doing?
That's a key question. Nobody would really understand that, except that, and the CIA had a history doing this with the smoke jumpers. What they needed in most of their deniable wars, their guerrilla operations, was a supply operation. For example, in Laos, they recruited the Hmong Hill people, who really came from the Iron Age, as a mobile guerrilla force in a roadless country, defending the king against the communists. How do you supply a roadless a group of mountain people in a mountainous forest? Well, the easy answer is you drop supplies, munitions, and food out of airplanes, and you have to feed the villagers the same way. Once you take all their men to go fight the communists, you've got to feed them, and you have to drop food to them. Well, why don't you use the Air Force? Because this was to be a deniable war. The heyday of deniable war was the 50s and 60s. Both sides in that Cold War period wanted to avoid nuclear war. So they tried, even though they fought. they tried to avoid direct conflict between their national military forces. Even to this day, Russia tries to do something like this in the Ukraine. They have their forces in Ukraine, but they have them wear ski masks and explain them, oh, these are just guys on vacation. Deniable war was what was going on. John Kennedy didn't invent it in 1961 when he and directed the CIA to go in there.
Okay, so let's flash forward, because we're just about out of time. Let's flash forward to what you've written now with your book, Kickers. Was there any concern for your own safety in divulging information that the CIA wants kept secret? Or has time allowed freedom of information to flow where you can now tell this story?
I have to answer that in two ways. The best writer, best historian of this war is a former Air Force officer by the name of Tim Castle. He was military liaison to the Laos government during that time, and he is an excellent historian, and he is as well connected to the people involved in this war as anyone I know. But even he says that this war is still so shrouded in myth and continuing government secrecy that we may never know the truth of it. It is... the whole attitude within the government to this day is we weren't there. Like everything, no secret is ever kept forever. When I interviewed the smoke jumpers, they were 70 years old then, like I am, and I would interview them in groups. I wouldn't do that as a lawyer for various reasons, but it worked wonderfully. Because they would always correct and comment on each other's stories. When I would ask them what they considered a sensitive question, they would kind of turn to each other and say, "Did Gar say, is it okay with Gar if we talk about this?" Gar Thorsrud was the CIA air branch officer to whom they reported the guy that they worked for 15 years. Everybody would kind of nod to each other and say, yeah, I think Gar thinks this is public stuff. So they were a little sensitive about it because they had worked for the CIA for so long and been told not to talk about it. It continues to be guarded. As for my own safety, security, the story is out there in broad outline. So there's never been an article about a story about the smoke jumper, the use of smoke jumpers by the CIA.
The book is called Kickers, a novel of the secret war. It's written by Patrick Lee. Patrick, I thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Peter, I enjoyed it very much, and thank you for the opportunity.
Patrick Lee, author of Kickers, a novel of the secret war. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0283, and you'll find the links to Patrick's site, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRigo Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. Some of the best advice I've ever heard for dealing with lawsuits came, coincidentally, from a man who had the best name of any lawyer I've ever heard of, too. His name was Learned Hand. Yes, really, and he graduated from Harvard Law School more than 100 years ago. True to his name, he became one of the most learned and respected judges in the history of the United States. The opinions he wrote are still cited in court. After presiding over hundreds of lawsuits during his long career, this is what he had to say on the subject, and I quote, "Litigation is to be dreaded beyond almost anything short of sickness or death." End of quote. Now, let's be fair, sometimes the only way to resolve our differences is through a lawsuit. But what Judge Hand knew is that lawsuits should be used only as a last resort. Because of the time and money lawsuits cost everyone involved, his advice is as good today as it ever was. Find out more. Visit our website at centerforamerica.org.
If you or someone you care about is struggling with food and body image issues, don't ignore the signs. Eating disorders are serious, potentially life-threatening illnesses. But recovery is possible, and you don't have to suffer alone.
Call the National Eating Disorders Association helpline at 800-931-2237 or visit nationaleatingdisorders.org to take a confidential online eating disorder screening. Recovery is possible.
From our studios in Montreal, Canada, and going out to the rest of the world, this is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's time to crack a spine. The Stuff File presents Book Banter with Stuart Nauman. Once again, here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And you know, yesterday, all my troubles seemed so far away. But that's a story for another day. We have Stuart Nauman here with another edition of Book Banter. Hello, Stu.
Hi, Peter. I thought you were going to talk about your fondness for scrambled eggs, but I guess that was wrong.
See, now only true Beatles fans will know what you just talked about there.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I was realizing how these days how viable some scraps of paper can be, because the Beatles never wrote lyrics to their songs on normal pieces of paper. They did it on like everything from scrap pieces of paper they would find in hotel rooms or greeting cards, and pen their original lyrics for their songs. And these scraps of paper are fetching high prices at auction these days.
Interesting.
Amazing, isn't it?
Yes.
I mean, millions of dollars for scrap pieces of paper with lyrics. But for the past 50 years, Peter, everything about the life and career of the Beatles, both individually and collectively, have been written about, analyzed, dissected, studied, examined, and evaluated by journalists, experts, and fans alike. Now, one aspect of the Fab Four that has held a peculiar fascination is their songs that have been written and recorded by them between 1962 and 1970, especially the stories behind their respective origins. Now, journalist and author Hunter Davies, who wrote the first and only authorized biography of the Beatles, which was published in 1968, tackles the Beatles songs. However, this time he focuses on the words that went so well with their music in this fascinating study, The Beatles Lyrics. So from Love Me Do to Her Majesty, Davies gives a chronological look at the songs that appeared on their British albums that were released on Parlophone during the 60s, as well as the hit songs that did not appear on any of their UK albums, from the point of view of the lyrics. Now, Davies gives the reader a great deal of interesting stories behind the words to see how the Beatles, as well, mostly the team of Lennon and McCartney, came up with some of the most famous and most memorable words in the history of rock music. Like, for example, In My Life actually began as a long-form poem by John about his growing up in Liverpool. The title of the song Getting Better from the Sgt. Pepper album was taken from a phrase that drummer Jimmy Nicol used to say a lot. If Beatles fans know Jimmy Nicol, he was the man who substituted for Ringo Starr during the Australian tour in 1964 because Ringo had his tonsils out. Help was actually written as a sort of cry of help from John, who was beginning to get weary of the fame that Beatlemania was bringing to him at the time. And also, we were mentioning about Yesterday earlier in this broadcast.
Yes.
Well, that the lyrics to Yesterday came to Paul during a drive he took with then-girlfriend Jane Asher during a vacation in Portugal while he was still tooling around with its famous working title, Scrambled Eggs.
Yes.
Yes. Now, Davies keeps the reader's attention quite well with his combination of lyric analysis and background stories. Most of these stories culled from the time he spent with the group when he was researching his famous book. However, another main attraction of this book is the 100 original drafts that are peppered throughout the text and almost looks like a museum catalog. In fact, most of those pieces of paper are from Davies' personal collection, which are now housed in the British Library in London. So to give the reader a rare glimpse of the rough drafts of Beatles' creative process and what some of the original lyrics might have ended up in the finished song if it wasn't for a last-minute change or adjustment because a certain verse didn't sound or rhyme properly. So the book The Beatles Lyrics is an insightful, authoritative look at how the most memorable lyrics in rock music came to be and the circumstances behind those memorable lyrics. Beatle fans everywhere have to thank Hunter Davies for his tireless efforts in tracking down these original drafts that forever changed the face of rock music. So we can get the opportunity to see how every yeah, yeah, yeah came to be from their own hand, to the page, to the recording studio, to the record stores. It's a fine testament to the creative legacy of the Fab Four.
And the book is called?
It's called The Beatles Lyrics. It's edited by Hunter Davies, published by Little Brown, and it's $39.
Now, 2 weeks ago on this very program, you were talking about Monty Python, and so or John Cleese, to be specific.
Yeah.
So I have to ask the question, because when you mentioned When I asked you at the time, is there other books in this genre on this topic that people can talk about? You said there was a host of Python books. I'm assuming the same can be said for the Beatles.
Well, to say the least. Actually, that's the great dilemma when there's so much, you know, available there. You have to be very selective. But what I did was I narrowed it down, and I basically decided to use two books that are Beatle books, but that were Hunter Davies had something to do with them. For example, the 1968 biography that Hunter Davies put together about the Beatles, which was the only authorized book about them, which if you get the original edition like I did, I have the original hardcover edition, it's rare to find, but it has been reissued and updated a few years ago. And also, a couple of years ago, Davies edited another book of this nature, like the Beatles lyrics, but it's called the John Lennon Letters. And he's went through a lot of Lennon's letters from the time he was in Liverpool Art College in the late 50s, early 60s, up until his death, that gives another side to John Lennon, that John Lennon was quite the prolific letter writer.
Okay, and again, this current book, the one we're talking about today, is?
The Beatles Lyrics by Hunter Davies. It's edited by Hunter Davies, published by Little Brown, and it's $39.
And as I mentioned earlier, yes, two book banters in a row. You've dealt with something British. Are you ever coming back from across the pond?
Yes, I shall go back to the colonies eventually. Maybe one day return to Mother England, but I don't know when that will be.
Okay.
But yeah, if you want me to do a bunch of book banters about the Commonwealth, hey, no problem. That could be done.
And if people want to find you, assuming they don't, have to travel British Airways, how can they find you?
Well, you could put away your hovercraft because you could find me in print, not in the News of the World anymore, but in Montreal Times, or also online. Don't need a hovercraft for that. Or you just go to www.mtltimes.ca. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Excellent. Thank you very much, Stuart.
Oh, you're welcome, Peter.
Stuart Nolman with another edition of Book Banter here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File.
And we're just about a racetrack on this edition of the Stuff File program. I have one more story to share with you before we get to our idiot of the day. On November 6th, a couple aged 68 and 65 were hospitalized after spending almost 13 hours locked inside their car in their own garage in Alexandria, New Zealand. The night before, they had been unable to remember a salesman's tutorial on how to unlock their new Mazda 3 from the inside and had spent the night assuming they were trapped because they had forgotten to bring along the battery-operated key. The wife was unconscious when neighbors finally noticed them, and her husband was struggling to breathe. The door unlocks, by the way, manually, of course. Yeah. Okay, we're dealing with new technology here, and they're 68 and 65, and that's the only reason I didn't give them serious consideration for idiots of the day. But they were right on the edge of this week's voting process. However, I'll let you know right now that the moment you're waiting for is here, because this is the idiot of the day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. This Stuff File presents the idiot of the day.
And okay, this idiot of the day is not just an idiot, he's a dangerous idiot. 19-year-old Nicholas Todd Hellman admitted he tried to kill the guy seeing his ex-girlfriend by putting a scratch-and-sniff greeting card in the victim's mailbox after lacing it with ricin, a poison so deadly that less than 2 milligrams can kill an adult if inhaled. The plot came to light when Hellman bragged about the delivery to a co-worker at a Target store in Warrington, Pennsylvania. The co-worker called police, and police found more ricin in Hellman's apartment. He faces at least 5 years in prison for attempted murder, but that's not the end of his troubles. Hellman has also been charged with trying to get his jail cellmate to kill the detective in the case, kidnap the prosecutor, and rip out his tongue and burn out the eyes of his Target co-worker. The cellmate, naturally, turned him in. Okay, some people just don't know when to quit when they're behind. I mean, why attempt to go to such great lengths to hold a grudge and then either brag about it or bring in accomplices that you don't really know? Well, there are two reasons this time around in this case. One, he's clearly a psychopath. And two, He's an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program, number 0283. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0283. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You could also find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder. And don't forget to check out the Stuff File store, where you can purchase a plethora of Stuff File merchandise, from t-shirts to mugs to tote bags to mouse pads. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, streaming on PCJ Media and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on iTunes and Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it for this week. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. Today's broadcast could be heard directly in your home, car, or wireless device, or on your computer, so you can listen on an outpatient basis. For those of you hearing this show directly inside your head, please adjust your medication.